Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
It's very nice to be here, and I have to say, on listening to how Helen described her career, I would say mine is essentially the mirror image of this in almost every way. I started out in life, in fact, as an academic. I was a lecturer in economics at Harvard, and I was an associate professor of finance at the Stanford Business School. But then I decided that, in fact, I used to teach executive education classes in the summers, and I decided the questions that the executives were asking me were much more interesting and more difficult to deal with than the questions the students would ask me. So I said, well, that's it. I'm going to go and do the interesting things. And so I left academia, and I did a variety of things in a variety of countries. I became a management consultant with McKinsey, and I spent 7 years in San Francisco, and then a bit more than seven years in London. And then I went into the investment banking business, and I talked one of my clients into buying S.G. Warburg, a storied British institution, and I became the global head of investment banking for SBC Warburg, as it was then called. And I ended up running a business with 1,000 people around the world, corporate financiers. And then I went into the private banking business of Swiss Bank, and then we merged Swiss Bank with UBS. And I built, in fact, what was called the onshore private banking business. Onshore, if you don't know Switzerland, onshore private banking is where your customers live in various countries and pay taxes, and offshore is the suitcase. Okay? So I ran all of the honest business, and I had a colleague who ran the offshore business. And after that, I was involved in venture activities. In fact, I was one of a group of people who took a venture fund public on the AIM in 2000, just before the market tanked. You'll be happy to know. I had various other funny experiences. I mean, in 1996, we underwrote the first Russian bond since Tsarist times. It was very exciting. And I remember all the bonds sold out in one day, and I went home and told my wife. I said, you know, we sold all those bonds, and then I paused and I said I wouldn't buy one. And of course, they all defaulted in 1998, but that wasn't my responsibility then. So then in the private banking business, I was on the other side, and suddenly it was my responsibility. And then we lived in Britain for 10 years, from 88 to 98, and then I was born in Vienna, and I grew up in Australia, then moved to the United States. Then we lived in Britain, then we moved to Switzerland, then went back to the United States, and I started a wealth management business with a business plan, and I ran around and looked for money, actually, and raised some money and started this thing. And I sold out of that in May of this year, in fact, and came to Aston. So whereas Helen has had 30 years of being in higher education, I haven't had 30 weeks in that sense, and I have a very different perspective on it. So what I want to do now is give you a perspective as I see what I'm doing as the dean and where I think things are going. And since I haven't got much experience in it, you may say, well, it may not be worth listening to, but if you have the patience, I'll try it out on you. So I want to group my remarks into three subjects. First, an opportunity for business schools, and I'll be talking in particular about ours, obviously. Secondly, the funding situation for higher education in the UK. And thirdly, what I would call the operating mindset, how people think. Remember, I come from a world of not only private industry, but probably the, for good or ill, the most fast-moving part of private industry, the global financial system, and so on. And so I have a certain perspective on some issues that the last few questions were all about here. If some people think this is slow, I was in a place where you made decisions like this and you gambled lots of money on the decision like that. So you had to think very hard and act very quickly. So let me start by talking about what I see as an opportunity today the world of business school education. Now, it's no novelty to say that a business school has multiple constituencies. We've got current undergraduates and postgraduates. We've got the alumni of the undergraduate program and the postgraduate program. We've got the current and prospective employers of our students. We've got the local communities in which we operate. There's the government, which is still a direct and indirect source of most of our money. And last but not least, of course, the faculty and the staff. I'm going to talk about an opportunity that is primarily focused on the business community around us, but this opportunity holds benefits for all of the stakeholders here. And this is a particularly compelling opportunity. It's one of the reasons, in fact, I came here to Birmingham. And let me just say then that, as a quick summary, there is a real shortage of external sources of ideas and support for all but the largest enterprises in the Midlands. I could make that argument for the UK as a whole. And there's an enormous need for this support. The Midlands economy is only now recovering momentum from a long and deep financial crisis, and I want to point out I was not responsible for this crisis, though I was there at the time. And there's been a very substantial period of loss of competitiveness outside the service sector. And at the same time that you see unemployment still above historical averages, it's again no surprise that there's a shortage of workers with technical skills. And there's also a shortage of managers with who can handle global markets, global workforces, and complex financial issues. And again, looking around the Midlands, you've got entrepreneurs. Some of them are the young, newly minted graduates of places like Aston. Some are veterans. All of them are finding it impossible or very difficult to obtain venture funds, to obtain mezzanine funds, or even just plain working capital in order to create and grow businesses. And certainly, coming from the United States, in particular coming from California, what you see is that large companies can find people, can find advice, and can find finance from many sources, and small and medium-sized companies simply can't. I mean, this is, to me, odd. In fact, it's a very un-American situation, if I can put it in those terms, whether you're thinking about consulting companies or venture capital firms or private equity and mezzanine financiers. There's an army of supporters of small and medium-sized enterprises that are eager to offer their services in California. Universities are constantly contacted by people trying to commercialize their intellectual property. And in fact, I'll go so far as to say that in the US, it is probably more prestigious to be the CEO of a tiny startup company than to be the senior executive of some large corporation. No one is interested in you as a cocktail party if you are some faceless executive in a suit from some large corporation. They'd much rather hang around someone who's 25 years old and has just started a business. This is, if I can say so, pretty much the opposite of the situation one finds in this country, where the prestige rankings tend to run the other way around. And this provides a lot of opportunity for business schools. A business school can be a reservoir of knowledge that can help remedy this situation. Our faculty could help guide some transformative changes in the way in which the management of small companies go about growing their businesses. At Aston, we've had this type of impact because we're running the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses Program in our region. And we also provide encouragement and training in how to pitch for money to budding entrepreneurs. We are moving on from this. We're now contemplating acting as a focal point for the discussion of development of those missing parts of the financial system to fund growth locally and globally. Another thing we're doing, we've done a little and we're going to do a lot more, which is quite unusual as far as I can tell in the world of higher education in the UK, is intensive joint work with the other schools, with engineering and applied science, life and health sciences, language and social sciences, partly to broaden education, partly to help commercialise the intellectual property that these schools produce. And even if you're going to be an engineer or a doctor, if you're going to rise in your profession, you're going to eventually have to learn how to manage teams of people and manage budgets. The average NHS practice has millions of pounds running through it, which is much more money than goes through the average business in the UK today. So there's a sense in which we need, as business school professionals, to connect with so many parts of the university and not just within our school. So these are the sorts of things that certainly I'm working on and promoting within the business school, and these things have benefit beyond the benefit to the community. Undertaking these kinds of activities enhances the access of our faculty to raw material for research. It enriches their ability to teach because the examples that are given in the classroom are real-life examples and personal examples rather than cases taken from textbooks. Something I'll come back to in a minute. At a time of tightened budgets, consulting and training opportunities can provide extra resources for universities and extra income for faculty. And finally, because small and medium-sized businesses are the backbone of every economy in the world, Any skills you can develop to assist small and medium-sized enterprises are exportable everywhere in the world. Every business school, every university has its international strategy, its globalization strategy. We're going to work on one which plays to our particular advantages. And this means that you can export knowledge about how to deal with small and medium-sized enterprises in terms of executive education, degree-focused education, and consulting services. Now, I'm not trying to imply that this should be the direction for all or even most business schools. Some of the most famous business schools in this country have as their core activity producing a skilled entrance into the financial machine in the city or grooming the senior management of the FTSE 100. But I think that this is the best direction for our school, and that's where we're going to be travelling as an institution. So let me turn to the funding situation, because if the opportunity to benefit the community by promoting enterprise is the good side of the coin, then university funding is the bad side of the coin. Looked at from the outside, over a very small period, UK universities have moved from what I could caricature as being part of the civil service to being part of a global market economy. It's a very short period in which to make such a dramatic transition. Direct government support has been substantially withdrawn. Now the government money flows primarily indirectly with home student choices via loans to fund tuition. Universities that are appealing to students get money. Those that are not so appealing get less money. And in what I would describe as an extraordinarily dumb way of going about this move to a market economy, the cost side of higher education has been totally liberalised. So we pay market prices for faculty and for every other cost, but the revenue side of higher education remains price controlled by politicians. Look, for example, at the reluctance or the absolute refusal to raise tuition in line with inflation. Every other cost that, you know, I'm writing the checks, every other cost goes up with inflation, the revenue doesn't, which means in real terms, our income is shrinking around 3% a year. This is a brilliant idea. Turning to research, direct government funding for research is also constrained, and speaking again from the perspective of Aston, appears to be increasingly concentrated in what I would describe as a self-declared elite group of institutions. The problem with that is that different schools will choose different paths to success, and it's not clear that there will be a willingness to have research funds follow anything but the most orthodox choices. So if you absorb all of this, then that leaves universities with very few options for finding funds to invest in the quality of teaching, in the quality of research, and in benefits to the community. And I can list all of these. First, obviously, attracting more home undergraduates, but there are still all sorts of constraints around that imposed by the government. Secondly, bringing in foreign students, because there are no caps on tuition for them. Luckily, the government is deciding they don't get visas. There was an interesting article in the Financial Times just this morning about the contradiction between one part of the government running around saying we want this to be, you know, one of our great exports, and the rest of them saying keep all these bloody foreigners out. But apparently this hasn't stuck the people in Whitehall as contradictory yet. Next step, of course, which you've all seen, create some plethora of master's courses to attract students because the tuition is uncapped. Then you can compete for European research grants because they're still available more generously than those in the UK. And finally, you can sell services to industry for more than it costs to produce these services. If you sell it for less than it costs, it doesn't work. So what do we conclude from this? Well, what I conclude is that our business schools are turning into marketing machines. We're employing agents to find foreign students. We're employing consultants to make it more likely that our research grant applications will make it through the Brussels bureaucracy. We're inventing and closing courses according to short-term market moves. We're scrambling for executive education and consulting opportunities. This is not one's description of an institution of higher education. It sounds more like Procter & Gamble or Lever. And of course, and this is something that I'm sure you in this room have already started to feel, there is a constant pressure to become more efficient and more effective in every aspect of university operation. So these are the consequences of the change in the funding situation. And let me turn to the final point I want to make, which is what I would call, coming from the outside again, the operating mindset. If you come to higher education from private industry, nothing is strange in the description I have just given. All competitive industries going through fundamental changes experience these kinds of stresses, experience these kinds of experiments, see people scrambling to see if the business can be resurrected, changed, or adapted, but we're not in private industry. And there are two fundamental factors that, to me, are going to make working our way through these changes particularly difficult. The first is that the incentives for the motor of our vehicle, the academic faculty, are not well aligned with the things that need to be done. And secondly, for most people whose formative years were in the civil service version of higher education, the required changes may be both difficult to accept and difficult to adopt. Let me start by talking about academic incentives. The representative, let's say the prototypical faculty member, is called research active. That means that her success in the eyes of other academics is measured primarily via published articles in prestigious refereed journals. The quantity and the quality of these has been the main driver of promotion, and it's the central part of the just completed ref, for example. The more such articles an academic has, the more portable she is, and the more likely she is to have moved between universities in search of promotion, pay, and fund people to do research with. Again, as a caricature then, for such an academic, a university is a support umbrella allowing primary focus on research. And teaching is, for the most part, a necessary chore in order to get the time for research. Now, it's certainly true that a number of distinguished academics really enjoy teaching. And it's also true that a number of distinguished academics genuinely care about what the ref has termed impact of research on the community. But I am confident that I have described the motivation of the majority of research-active faculty. This attitude sits somewhat uncomfortably with the opportunities I began by describing, nor does it make it easy to work together to address the university funding challenge. Now let me turn to the other aspect of this, the difficulty in accepting changes. This is where things get most personal, most directly. In a world of rising competition and tightening funding, it is simply not acceptable to be mediocre, to just get along, whether at teaching, research, or community-oriented functions, or administration, or anything else, because there just isn't enough money to go around. Each person has to strive to excel at something, or they aren't going to have a home in that institution. What were once gentle, non-confrontational homes need to acquire much sharper elbows. Now, that's a tough thing to say, but there is an even tougher corollary. Who is going to make this evaluation, and who is going to have those hard words to tell people to shape up or ship out? Who is going to have to be the mentor and the supervisor and the evaluator and the ultimate decider of what happens? Only colleagues. Who else is in a position to judge the quality of work, whether that's teaching, research, community engagement, or administrative support? Certainly not a dean or a chief operating officer who could evaluate a number of direct reports, but who have no hope of evaluating faculty and staff numbering in the hundreds. So what you have to have in such an environment is a delegated management structure where people who are working closely with others are making those tough judgments. Are you doing as much as you can and as much as you should? If you aren't, can I help you do better if after being helped? So what you have is a situation, and Helen referred to this when she talked about some of the changes I was making in the way that the business school runs. You have people in management roles who are heads of academic groups, heads of various administrative teams. These people need to make decisions faster. They have to impose tough performance tests. They have to have difficult conversations. And if every reasonable remedial measure has failed, then they have to have the most difficult conversation of all. The problem, of course, is that talented and successful people in academic institutions didn't sign up for this. And indeed, sometimes they enter the academic world precisely to avoid doing these sorts of things. So as far as I can tell, coming from where I come from, dealing with these incentive and attitudinal issues constitutes probably the most difficult challenge in the management of academic institutions in the coming years. So those are my thoughts. They're obviously not altogether gentle. And I'm happy to discuss anything that anyone wants to raise in this context. questions?
Challenges.
Hate them.
I think it's really interesting because we had a couple of people talk yesterday about culture change as well, Philippa did, and so on, and that seems to be a real theme that's coming up in terms of so on. So you found that a real, may I use the word, shock, coming in from a completely different sector? Is that?
Yes. I mean, it's in the nature of higher education that you can't do what you do in a corporate context. I mean, just the most trivial level, you're running an academic calendar, right? You can't change what you're going to do halfway through an academic year. You have to plan in advance. I mean, the decision cycle in an organization like a university is very different than in a shoe factory or something like that. It's a completely different notion. So it's inevitable that there is a much slower cycle. But to me, the misalignment of incentives and the reluctance to accept accountability for the quality of anything except one's own activity, these things are not found in commercial enterprises, and they constitute real challenges in adapting to rapid change. And the rate of change is externally imposed, it's not internally imposed. It doesn't matter what you want to do. If the money disappears, I keep talking about money, my colleagues think I'm terribly crass, but it has to. You can't write more checks than there is a balance in the account. So I think about this day and night, because the account's been run down to the point where these banks put on, you know, the overdraft charges. Yeah.
There's an expression, I guess, from the management of university staff, so trying to herd cats, and trying to get people to change can be extraordinarily difficult. And as somebody who's come from the finance sector, where one might argue that change was really being projected onto it, but yet have they changed? The bonuses are still there. Some would argue the corruption is still there. So, in a sense, trying to change academics is going to be extraordinarily difficult, because you mentioned that a lot of academics go into academia in order to avoid some of the real problematic aspects of working, being responsive to management. So, in a sense, it's almost like a wonderful conundrum to find oneself in a business school, where on the one hand, you're having to drive change, but on the other hand, you have to recognise that the people who need to change will resist it in the same way that, I guess, the bankers have done.
Well, I should say, first of all, that I ended up in the finance sector. In fact, I like to joke that you know, I started out in consulting, and I really enjoyed consulting, and I consulted with other enterprises and financial institutions, but I always felt that I didn't get enough respect, as they say, because people don't like consultants. You know, they say consultants borrow your watch to tell you the time. And so my punchline in this regard is, so I decided to go into an industry which was held in the highest regard, and I went into banking. So I think that we have to think through what you said in a different way. First, have financial institutions changed? Wasn't my particular concern. What I meant by that in general was that in commercial enterprises, decisions, operating decisions, can be made much more quickly. Focus on this, focus on that. Is there a lack of integrity in this industry? Probably. Has it changed in the last 5 years, in the last 500 years? Probably not. Integrity or its lack is not industry specific. But there is one thing that we have to understand about things like financial institutions and perforce about universities or any organization. No one in them may like to change, but if the circumstances change, they die. Right? If you don't change, you die. There are many financial institutions that no longer exist. I was instrumental in buying S.G. Warburg, which was the gem in the crown jewel of British investment banking. And the reason we bought it for nothing. We bought it for the value, for book value, which in the case of the investment bank was essentially the value of the securities on the trading book. So we paid zero for the customer franchise of S.G. Warburg. It was probably the best acquisition ever made in this industry. How could we have done that? Because they started fighting with each other, and you can look at the history of this, books have been written about it. The people who ran it started fighting with each other and refused to adapt to change circumstances in this highly corrupt industry. The result was it literally disappeared, and many financial institutions have disappeared, some like Lehman Brothers or Barings, or, you know, I can give you a catalogue and you can think about it yourself. So it doesn't really matter whether people want to change or don't want to change. It doesn't really matter whether they're cats that don't like to be heard. If the external environment changes sufficiently negatively, either you adapt or you cease to exist. I mean, this is a reality of life which you can think about just reading newspapers, you will see. So as far as I'm concerned, the issue is not whether people like to do this, it's whether they have to do it. If there's enough leeway not to, then you don't. But if there isn't enough leeway, yes, things will disappear, institutions will disappear, jobs will disappear. You see what I'm saying? So this is the fundamental issue that's in front of us. And I don't know the answer to this. Remember, I've been in the higher education sector in Britain since the 2nd of June. But the important thing that all of us have to consider is what does it mean, this path that the government has pushed us all down on? What does it mean? If it means that funding is going to get concentrated in fewer hands, if it means that students are going to get picky, if they refuse to do this to the people who are in effect funding all our institutions, what can we do about it, whether we're cats or dogs, and like to be heard or not? So what I'm trying to say is that you don't want to look internally only. You have to look outside and say, what is the imperative around this? What do we need to do to prosper or to survive, if you want to take the negative view of it, when things change? And so it's an open question. Again, I've really only been doing this for a little less than 6 months, but you all know it better than I do. If it gets tough enough, things it cannot go on as they are. I mean, you all run budgets, right? Now think about it. So I'm the dean of the business school, so people waltz into my office and they want a pay increase, right? I mean, and not just one. I mean, it starts at the letter A and it works its way through the alphabet. So everybody wants a pay increase, and usually they have some good argument, right? I mean, they're not saying, oh, I woke up and decided I needed more money, they tell me they've published more, they've done this or that, or whatever. You can construct these arguments yourself. From what am I to pay them? You know, should I go to the students and say, even though the government says you only pay 9,000, I raised it to 10 because 3 of the faculty came in and they want to get paid more? You see what I'm trying to say? So what I'm telling my colleagues, and I'm literally telling them this, literally, I'm saying, if you want to pay the best performers more, you have to fire the poor performers, because I have to use their payroll to pay them less. This is not because I want to fire people. Where am I going to get the money from? Do you see what I'm saying? So this is the situation in which we find ourselves. Yeah, it's not me. It adds up. You know, there's only so much. So if some top performing person comes in and says, I want £20,000 a year more, well, you know, that's half a lecture, isn't it? So get out a saw, I say. But that's a fact. How else is anyone, any dean, forget me, how else is anyone to make a pay increase when the income comes from the students and the income is capped? You see what I'm trying to say? This is not... So it's not a... You get the idea. We're dealing with reality here. And part of what has to happen in these organisations that we're all in is that many people have to accept this reality. Right? It's no use to say the dean has to do it. I mean, I guess a caricature of the management model that I found coming into universities is the Kim Jong-il principle. Right? I'm the dictator. The dean has all the power. The dean is empowered to make every decision. No one else is really empowered to make any decision. You can't run anything complicated on that basis. How would I possibly know the performance of 120 faculty and 80 support staff and all of this? How would I decide whether something is worth £10,000 more or £10,000 less? So you need a completely different management approach, because those decisions have to be made because there isn't any more money. And this is, to me, the sort of overwhelming issue, and it gets more expensive. And if we have international aspirations, right, every university now, campus in whatever it is, everyone wants campus in China or wherever, even we have our aspirations.
operations in other places, and we're very small. Where does that money come from? Right? I mean, so, you see what I'm saying? If you're in running one of these places, all you confront are choices. You can't just do more. And so what you want to do is encourage more. You can get more. You can do, in fact, you can bring more foreign students, you can do more master's courses, you can get more research grants, and you can do consulting, or whatever you want to call it, executive education. No one likes these business words, even in a business school, but you can do more consulting and try and bring in net revenue. But if you don't do those things, that's it. There's no money. And so probably that's the sign I should put over my door. There is no money. And so, you know, it's a long-winded answer to a short question. I don't think we have any choice but to become better at generating revenue and better at discriminating between the quality of work that different people do, because we can't carry everybody. Because there isn't an unlimited amount of funds. You can't say someone's not doing a good job, let's hire someone else to patch the gap, because then you're paying two people to do the work of one. And where does that money come from? And so I'm like a broken record, because that's what I keep saying whenever everyone suggests spending some money on something. I'm not averse to it, but I'm saying, okay, why do you get, from where do I get the money to do this brilliant thing that you've conceived? And if they say, I can bring in a research grant, I can do this, I can do that, fine. Anything I can do to help is wonderful, and we'll marshal our troops and we'll do all of this. But that's to me, sitting where I sit, the operating reality. There's no escape from that. And so I think this is why it's so tough. There is an underlying culture that grew up in a different way. External forces, to wit, government policy, have changed entirely the structure which underpins this thing. And everybody's got to adapt, or they will not survive. I mean, it's as simple as that.
I'm very intrigued and agreed with all the things you're saying. I just wondered how many of your current faculty you think are on board with this reality that you're describing, and how good a chance have you got to persuade everybody, or do you think people will move on?
Well, this is an excellent question. These are discussions we have all the time internally. A number of the faculty at Aston have had business careers, so this isn't an alien concept to many people. We have, as you probably know, quite a lot of experience working with small businesses. I mentioned the Goldman Sachs program. Anyone who does that for a while understands very quickly what survival means. These little companies are much closer to the edge than any university you'll ever find. So I think there's a very substantial point of understanding. But, you know, 6 months... what I will say is that probably some people will think actually this is an opportunity, because I see it as an opportunity to do things differently, to do things better. Others may not like it. But the question is what you move on to. Since I'm not describing the situation of Aston in any way, we're quite successful. We've exceeded our recruiting numbers and all of this. You know what I mean? There's nothing bad about our situation. This is the situation of the higher education sector in the UK in general, as you're all well aware. My tale could be told in any place, really, except in those few which have a very large endowment. You know, I said I taught at Harvard and Stanford. They have endowments over $30 billion. So when you have a $30 billion endowment, then you can take the long view, right? What's a bad? No, I'm serious. You can't take a look. What's a bad year? Yeah, take out a few hundred million and move on. This is what it took a while to get the $30 billion. And in fact, the $30 billion came, and this is something that that cuts back to the opportunity at the beginning. That money doesn't come from £10 gifts, right? It in fact comes from a minority of people who've been economically very successful. So what you get is you get $20 million, $50 million, $100 million requests and gifts from a small number of people, and it doesn't take that many to get to a billion. You can do the arithmetic, right? So essentially, one of the fundamental issues for the university system in our country is to foster people who are going to be both successful and grateful. And you all have alumni. And many of them will say the finest years of their lives were the years they spent with you in your university. You know this is true. So part of our challenge is to help them not only be happy with their education, but to be prosperous as a result of the skills they've acquired. And I think we can do that. And there are, you know, the Oxfords and Cambridges of the world have those large endowments. And that's why they don't worry as much as I do about whether the tuition covers the cost of teaching. The fact that Oxford and Cambridge doesn't. Right? They have this tutorial system, and they spend more on each student than the student pays. They don't care. Right? Because the yield on the endowment more than compensates for the lack of tuition. And now they're arguing with the government they should be allowed to raise, but you know, are they going to die if they don't know? So you see, there are ways forward, but they're all things that we have to adapt to. And haven't been done for the most part in most institutions. So this is what's going on here.
Hi, I'm Paula from Manchester Met University. Could you give us your view on what you think a good advisory board would look like for a business school in the UK?
Oh, that's an excellent question, because we've been working on ours. So, I think that the I think let me start by saying what I think the role of a business school is, and then I'll jump to the advisory. A business school is a strange kind of academic creature because it's not a classic sort of research and educational institution. Its rationale is that of a professional school, right? You're trying to train people to do something. We're really doing dentistry, we're not doing physics in a business school, yes? And many of our faculty have difficulty getting their heads around this notion of creating dentists, but they are. And so a business school is a bridge between intellectual thinking and the business community. That's really what we do best by way of education, by way of research. You're taking quite abstract concepts and you're trying to figure out how they work in real life, and you're trying to take real life and put it back into abstract concepts. We're a bridge. So to me, an advisory board is a bridge between the business school and two parts of the outside world, the alumni and the business community. Because advisory boards can't work at all if they have too many members. You know, if you get 60 people in a room and have a chat, that, you know, it's all over. If each person talks for 3 minutes, that's 3 hours, right? So that doesn't work. So advisory boards have a certain role in connection to the outside community, but only if you can get some advisory board members who are connected to some substantial institution like a chamber of commerce or something where you, in effect, multiply their impact. So to me, the single most important thing an advisory board can do for you is connect you to alumni in as many ways as possible. If I think of Aston, again, we have alumni all over the world. I mean, because UK has been such a mecca for students from every country, we all have alumni, you know, in every country under the sun, practically. And so what you really need is to mobilise these alumni. They have enormous value. I mean, this is how you really get good students, through word of mouth, not through paying agents to go out there and hang up shingles in little booths. You want someone to say, you know, I went to Aston. Someone in China to say, I went to Aston, and you ought to go too, because it was tremendous, not hire an agent and so on. So part of what you want is that these advisory board members are instrumental. They're focal points for alumni mobilisation on a global basis. If you can do that, then you get feedback from the alumni and you provide them with ongoing services. And this is, I think, a very, very valuable function for an advisory board. We're also using our advisory board to mentor our best students as a sort of a perk. So if you're really a top student, we'll get one of the advisory board to be your mentor. And this is actually a reward. But again, how many people are on the advisory board, right? So how many people can you mentor? But I mean, it's a real perk for these students. We have some really good people on the advisory board. They've got successful business careers. And it's nice as a student to have someone like that spend even a few hours with you and talking to you about things. And you can bounce ideas off them. So those are the things that we're using our advisory board for. Essentially, many different dimensions of alumni relations and mentoring. And it's all part of this bridging function that I see for a business school in general.
Angela Gill from University. Just wondering what your view is on the threat from private sector providers of business education. There's clearly easy money to be had in business education, and in the university environment, business schools fund the underperforming, financially underperforming areas in the rest of the university. So what's the threat from private providers?
Yes, I have to say, one of the... Since you made this remark, Ian, I'll start with that and work backwards. So one of the things that I found most extraordinary when I took up this occupation was that when I met other deans of business schools, they all said, oh, the university's taxing us, you know, we're supporting the university. And I thought, yeah, you know, probably that's true. People are willing to pay more in tuition to go to a business school than to the School of Modern Dance. I don't see this as a criticism of the School of Modern Dance, but a number of my colleagues seem to. What's the impact of private education? And that's actually a very complicated question, because education isn't homogeneous, and there are certain kinds of... The same question could be asked with MOOCs, which is the ultimate in private education, where there isn't even an institution in a sense. So there are some things you can teach quite well in an abstract manner, if we go to the MOOCs, like code, computer code. It's much more difficult to teach game theory and negotiation through a MOOC. So I think that what's emerging very rapidly is that there are different kinds of things which will be displaced in different kinds of ways. I come from the United States. There's a very large private education sector in the United States. It is, in fact, generally considered to be even worse than the financial industry, by far, in the sense that in some of these private university systems, less than 10% of the students actually graduate. But they pay the tuition. And they're loaned money by the government, which they have to repay even if they don't graduate. So in the American system, you borrow money for tuition, but the repayment it's a regular loan. It's not a part of your income like it is here. You just owe money. It's like, you know, borrowing anything else. And you owe it whether you graduate or not. And under American law, the one debt you cannot get out of through declaring personal bankruptcy is student loans. So you can get out of a mortgage, you can get out of any debt on earth except a student loan. So what these private education providers in the US have done is essentially create literally hundreds of thousands of people in desperate financial situation with a very low graduation rate. And these private education providers in the United States have essentially been milking the government loan scheme. That's their real business model. It's not educating people. It's using it as a vehicle to get cash in from the US government. This is now well accepted. It's not me speaking a radical agenda. So the private education sector in the United States is not considered a success in general at the university level. Not at all. You know, there are private education institutions which do what I would call further education. You know, they can teach you to be a mechanic or something like that. They have a somewhat better track record. So there are certain things that, where you really can't distinguish between public and private. Nursing education in the United States is partly done in public institutions and partly done in private institutions. There really isn't, by and large, any differentiation in the quality or in the cost, for that matter, because these are standalone nursing things. They're not subsidizing. You know, so there are parts where it has worked well, but in the US context, it's been a pretty general failure at the university level. So, you know, if you look at that as an example, you'd say, well, do I have much to worry about? If you look at what's going on here, it's much younger. But then you have to ask yourself what constitutes success in education, and I think Helen was talking about that in particular. You have to say, so what makes successful education? What makes people want to go somewhere? And if it is engagement with really high-class academic faculty, so far you're not going to get it in a private educational institution, right? So there are certain things which can migrate into these categories, these so-called foundation degrees, you know, preparatory training. There's a lot of stuff you can see which is really straightforward in nature and doesn't require particularly sophisticated teaching skills and so on. So I think that's what will happen. I don't quite see, certainly from my point of view and from my experience elsewhere, I don't see this as being a major issue. Now, there is a difference, however. In the US, there isn't any particular dependence on foreign students. There's a significant number of them, especially at the postgraduate level, but it's not a core. The US doesn't see itself as having a huge export industry in education. I don't know how students in Thailand would differentiate between a private university in the UK and a public university. You know, I don't know how well that would flow, but I imagine that on a word-of-mouth basis, these quality differences will emerge. So that's not my major concern at the moment. I don't think of it as a huge issue. There may be bits of it that become significant, but at the moment I think our bigger challenges are the stuff I was talking about earlier, making our own processes more flexible and adaptive and limited, and fundamentally ending mediocrity. I mean, the fundamental problem of what I would call a civil service mentality, there's not really civil service, you can see it in private industry wherever there's an oligopoly. Unless you have some real competition, I mean, think of the old British Gas. I remember what happened when I used to call British Gas in the 1980s. Oh my God, they were doing me such a favour by showing up. Well, you know it's true, right? And when these companies became private, you know, think about it. You think of these cable companies and so on, trying to get them to install internet connection in less than 4 weeks or something. Why? Because there's no competition. Who else is going to do it, right? In your area, there are two of them. They both decide they're not going to show up. What do you do then? So this is not a phenomenon of private versus public. It's a phenomenon of competition versus lack of competition. When there's no competition, everyone says, oh, why work? They've got no choice, right? They've got no choice. And so, you know, our problems have to do with making our culture more flexible and adaptable. I don't think the private education sector doesn't strike me as something I would invest my money in, unless I were milking the US government, but that's unethical. And I don't do that anymore. No, no. I have repented. I want you all to know that. I'm not responsible for the financial crisis. I don't do these things anymore. I regret underwriting that Russian bond. I also sold Greek bonds. I mean, I can tell you stories forever, but I don't do that anymore. No. I have an honest face.
I'm Claire from MMU. Could you tell me about how... I'm on the Goldman Sachs program at MMU, so I know about all businesses. How do we make knowledge that we generate in business schools relevant and accessible to the people that want to buy it?
This is an excellent question, and this gets at the heart of this misalignment of incentives. It's in the outer language. Look at the papers that your faculty write. Look at the titles of these papers and tell me what they mean half the time. Tell me what they mean, even if the subject matter actually is quite sensible. There is nothing that makes it more impressive than to take a two-syllable word and make it into a ten-syllable word, right? And all these unbelievable things. And so it's all, and they all entertain each other, right? So they're all in their friends, they're the editors of the four-star journals, and they pass their little papers around, and everybody's happy. Hey, I publish papers in four-star journals, I can tell you. So they all do this, and they're all happy. And then he gets some poor mug out there who actually wants to make a living running a machine shop and supplying parts to Jaguar. And you say, hey, I'm from Aston University, I'm here to help you, and here's what I'm going to talk to you about, and then they pass out or throw you out, one or the other. So I was actually part of the industry, as I said earlier, which had to step into that breach, the management consulting industry, right? I went from being a professor to being a management consultant, and I used all this academic stuff I had done, but I expressed it in language that someone could understand. This was enormously valuable, right? I mean, bizarrely enough. So this is part of the misalignment of incentives. No academic is going to feel totally rewarded by writing one or two syllable words in short sentences. I mean, when I was a professor, I can barely remember, I used to make my PhD students say, I had a degree in what was once called mathematical economics, but the point was that all these papers are written, all these symbols and mathematics and stuff. I made all my PhD students get up and describe what they were doing in plain words with no equations. If they couldn't do it, I decided they didn't know what they were talking about. This is still true. It's not what normally happens in our universities, right? This is not the main test. And until that becomes so, we will have difficulty succeeding. So if we take our version of the Goldman Sachs program, we have a minority of the faculty who do a wonderful job in it. They do not speak in academic terms. But if you talk to them, and this is the most interesting part, they will say, these are all senior people, they will say, I've gotten to the point where I don't have to do this anymore. Right? This is part of the misalignment of incentives that's sort of at the heart of this. If you're going to be valuable to the community outside, you have to express quite complicated things as simply as possible if they're going to be understood. This is not generally how you write academic papers. And this is a problem if you want to make that bridge. If you just want to write academic papers, it's not a problem. But if you want to do more than that, it becomes one. So this is one of the many things that we're going to have to struggle with, because the money's running out. If the government was always writing more money, then you'd say, well, why do I need to translate it, right? Someone else can do that. But if there isn't any more money, so that the only way you can get more money to do your own research is to do some of that, then you've got to be able to speak in those terms and think in that way. And we have a number of faculty who do, we have a number of faculty who don't. And so this is what I'm saying. The fundamental way in which the academic profession operates lends itself to certain things but not to others. And we've got to work on that. I don't know how successful we'll be remembered 6 months, so you can all laugh at me. I mean, I think you agree, I hope you agree with my interpretation of events, if not whether I have a solution for it. But this is what's actually going on in all around us.
Is there one more question?
Which one?
Which one?
Why don't we be really economic and
bid? Sorry?
Bid for the right. It's the business I come from. What's a question worth to you? A 5 or 10?
I'm Jed Dennis from University of Hull. My question is around the barriers to change, obviously changing these times. I mean, the key barriers here around trade unions, performance management, and performance-related pay. It's just going to happen, really. How are we going to get over those barriers, and are there any other particular ones that we think we need to get over?
Okay, I mean, I haven't been... This is the first time in my life I've been in a unionised industry. I have, in my limited experience with the union so far, at Aspen, I haven't had terrible experience. I haven't found unreasonable people. One should not make such decisions willy-nilly. It take too long, but you don't want to wake up one morning and decide you're going to terminate everybody or something. So I haven't found the union situation, at least at Aston, which is my only experience, in fact, not only in academic unions, but any unions, I haven't found that to be at all unreasonable so far. I think our union situation is not a problem. The general labour laws are a problem. Although I have to tell you, I was at an AACSB meeting of European Business School Deans, and I was at a dinner, and I sat next to this dean from a Belgian university, and I said, you'll like this. Belgian academics are civil servants, literally. You're only allowed to review them every 3 years, and they have to have 2 consecutive bad performance reviews. So you could not show up at work for 6 years. Literally not show up once. Not once, not for 5 minutes. And you have to be paid full salary for 6 years before they can fire you. So, you know, when you look at it that way, things are really rosy. I was astonished. I could barely finish eating. I mean, this is literally so close. So, but the point you're making is a serious one. So, we are dealing with the most intelligent people in the country. So, to me, the attitudinal issues, if you like, the herding cats issues, this is, to me, the main driver. I think that the other things are impediments, but they're fundamentally impediments because people don't want to adapt otherwise to the realities of the circumstance. Now, if you say, yes, but a lot of them won't, so what do we do then? Yes, then I think it may get very difficult. But everything can be achieved. It's not unreasonable, it's just ugly. And it's very awkward, but... It depends on the imperatives. You know, if you have time, if you're running a successful institution, if you think you can keep going, then you can do these things piecemeal. If there's a lot of pressure, then you don't have that luxury. And so, you know, you've got to make a judgment on how these evolutionary forces, which again are heavily opposed by the government in our context, how rapidly they will progress with this. Because we all depend so much on tuition, this capping the tuition, regardless of inflation, is actually incredibly onerous. If you compound even a 3% inflation rate for 3 or 4 years, you've erased your ability to keep a large chunk of the place going. So, you know, this is the fundamental issue, what the imperative is. So I haven't seen any fundamental issues, as I say, with the unions here. The labour laws are somewhat burdensome, but they're not totally unreasonable. But you don't want to get to that point if you can. You would like people to adapt and to realise what's going on. But I've only been doing it for 6 months. Maybe I'm totally naive. And I mean that in a serious way. I genuinely don't know. I have operated in other environments than in other countries, and so I just don't know. But so far, I think that the cat herding issue is the dominant issue more than the institutional constraints as such.
Okay, thank you, George. Sorry to cut it short, because I know Andy's got some questions and really fascinating, but probably want tea as well. So,
I can't stand in the way of tea.
So if everybody could show their appreciation to George.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.